This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
No end in sight to this week's genocide in Gaza, as the death toll from the relentless onslaught nears 23,000, most of them women and children. An international charity organization says over 10 Palestinian children lose one or both of their legs in Israeli attacks on Gaza every day. Also in the headlines, the U.S. military bases come under more attacks by the resistance groups in Syria and Iraq in retaliation for the American-Israeli genocide in Gaza. Welcome to our studios in the capital, Tehran. This is Mews. It's good to have you with us. Another day of deadly Israeli strikes on the Gaza Strip as the regime pushes its campaign of bombing of the coastal territory. Gaza's health ministry says 73 Palestinians have been killed in 24 hours. That brings the Palestinian death toll since October 7 to more than 22,800. Some of the latest Israeli attacks hit residential buildings in Khan Yunis as well as locations in Deir al-Bala, killing dozens. Israel has been bombing hospitals, schools, places of worships, and even UN-run facilities indiscriminately. Health officials in Gaza say Israeli drones bombed the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital on Sunday in an attack that targeted, quote, anything that moved. Medical charity groups have now evacuated the hospital. Displaced Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip are faced with hunger, thirst, diseases, and more Israeli bombing wherever they go.
There are nearly 33 people under the rubble, including women, children, and the elderly. At 12 a.m., suddenly as we were sleeping, a rocket hit us. No one has gotten out. They were all killed, children and women. They are under the rubble, and we keep digging to get them out in front of your eyes. Have a look. Here are their shoes. They are children. They are children. Look. Here are their diapers. They are all peaceful children. They are all children, and here are their belongings.
Enough of the war, enough of the pain, enough of the hunger, enough of the hurting. We are tired of everything in this life. There are no more basic needs to keep living this way. As you can see, it is difficult to make dough, to wash clothes. We have to bring water to drink and to wash. We are suffering.
Honestly, people's situation is very, very, very difficult. We are heading towards a very severe famine. May God protect us so that people do not die of hunger.
Sewage water is everywhere. We live with stray dogs and cats amid the garbage. We survive bombings, but diseases might kill us.
Every day in Gaza, more than 10 children on average lose one or both of their legs as a result of Israeli air and artillery strikes. That's according to the international charity organization Save the Children. The organization has cited statistics released by UNICEF, saying over 1,000 children have had one or both legs amputated since October the 7th. Many of them lost their limbs during operations carried out without anesthesia. That is because Gaza's healthcare system has been grappling with major shortages of medical supplies and staff over the past 3 months. The report by Save the Children illustrates one of the impacts of the Israeli onslaught on children's lives in Gaza. A British-Palestinian plastic surgeon who has been in the Palestinian territory describes the onslaught as a war on children.
With 10,000 children killed so far in this war, almost 1% of Gaza's children's population, it felt like a war on children. It felt like every day you would see more and more of these kids being brought in. And this is just the physical injury, not the mental health injury. And a lot of these children had in addition to the injury, have lost families, have lost parents. We had at one stage at Shifa Hospital 120 kids who were the sole survivors of their families on multiple generations and were wounded and had no one to look after them.
Abusita said children made up half of his operating list every day, adding that they had received devastating, life-altering injuries due to Israeli attacks. He said the number of patients coming in per day at the time of his service in Gaza was beyond anything that he had witnessed before. The British Palestinian medic gave evidence to the London Police's war crimes unit on his return from Gaza. He is set to offer his testimony on Israeli crimes at the Hague-based International Criminal Court. Burkhard Ngessa is a member of the Kenya-Palestine Solidarity Movement, who joins us from Nairobi in Kenya. Welcome to the program. There is a program that we run by the name of Viral Videos, of which we pick the different videos from the U.S.-Israel genocidal war in the Gaza Strip. One of the scenes, there is a woman whose body, half of her body has been blown away by either a bomb or it's been destroyed by shrapnel or what have you. And she's trying to, she's being pulled by a Palestinian with a rope, it seems. This, again, half of her body is gone, but she's still alive, and she's trying to cling on to life. This has been one of the harshest scenes perhaps witnessed by some, and is it exemplifies the genocide that's taking place. We're looking at 100 days coming up of this genocidal war. Isn't it quite startling that the world has not been able to enact anything, a mechanism of any kind, to prevent this from happening, which is still incurring at the rate of maybe 100 to 200 deaths, or I should say murders, on a daily basis practically?
Thank you. And first of all, it is very horrific what the world is observing happening in Gaza, and the helplessness of people who have interest in regard to influencing not just the public opinion, but using this war to try to only push, on their interest and not in regard to humanity. In fact, the scenes that have been coming from Gaza, which even the Zionist regime has done everything possible to make sure that there is a media blackout in Gaza. So the only pictures that we have been able to see of even babies being bombed or their legs being amputated, we could only say that this is the tip of the iceberg, because a full audit of the deaths that are taking place in Gaza is yet to take place, because now we are talking about over 22,000 deaths, which 80% of these deaths are, non-combatants. They are civilians. But the question that comes to mind is that even if we say after the World War II that never again shall we have such, a horrendous, bloodbath that to take place in this globe, but the truth of the matter is that there are a few people that continue to profit from war. So for them, war is a business, and to destabilize countries makes more money for them. And that is why we see the conflict between humanity, and those that, struggle only to get profits out of dehumanization of the process. And the amount of the children that now have been killed in Gaza, or even their legs are amputated, forget about the amount of mental anguish that these children will continue to suffer, even if they survive this war, cannot be actually be underestimated. And that is why you see that within the countries of the South, and at least those within the globe, even within the imperial core, that embrace, humanity, have been able to stand even shoulder to shoulder with the case that you have just mentioned in ICC, because what really amounts a genocide is well, established within the Rome Statutes, which I know the United States have not been a party to sign to it, but at least on the protocols that govern the what amounts to a genocide that the Israeli regime, the Israeli Zionist regime has been hanging on to cry victims of a Holocaust is actually being debunked now at the ICC with the support of the case that have just been filed by the South African embassy, because it is just not about the statements that the Israeli or the IDF officials have continued to, you know, to read or to say, you know, mentioning that this, the Palestinian people are not just human beings, but they are human animals. That is the rate of, you know, abuse that the people that are in charge of this Holocaust that is underway in Gaza have, you know, a twisted logic on what amounts to what they're calling peace and what amounts to be a genocide. In fact, they still continue to attack the supporters of the total liberation of the occupied territories of Palestinian people as the people who are supporting terrorism, because the global community cannot even agree who terrorists are. But we have seen before that the people who pick up arms to defend their right to statehood, to defend their right to land, to defend their right to dignity, to even protect the life of their children.
Thank you very much for that. We do appreciate it. That's Booker Ngessa, member of the Kenya-Palestine Solidarity Movement. Thank you. Yemen says the U.S. is framing Ansarullah Movement's operations in the Red Sea as a global threat to turn international attention away from Israeli massacres in Gaza. An Ansarullah spokesperson made the remark after the U.S. Secretary of State warned Yemen against further attacks on Israeli-bound ships that Antony Blinken claimed, quote, hurts people around the world. Mohammed Abdusalam hit back, saying the U.S. continued support for Israel could explode the region. He also warned against militarizing the Red Sea after Washington said that it is leading a coalition to patrol the waterway. Abdusalam said the U.S. and its allies cannot prevent Yemen from more operations against Israeli-destined ships. The Yemeni armed forces, in solidarity with Gazans, have launched missile and drone attacks on vessels operated by Israel or those heading to the regime's ports. An Iraqi resistance group says the recent attack against an Israeli site in the city of Haifa shows the resistance axis never gives up on its strategic goals in the region. A spokesman for the al-Najaba group said the strike is a clear message to the regime and is not an impulsive act. Hossein al-Mousavi said the objective of the resistance is to disrupt the U.S. plans in the region and to neutralize the efforts of Israel in Gaza. On Sunday, the Islamic resistance in Iraq said that it targeted a vital site in Haifa with a long-range cruise missile. Also in recent days, the resistance group has carried out several attacks against U.S. positions in Syria and Iraq. Meanwhile, there are reports of new strikes on U.S. bases in the region. In the latest attack, the U.S. base near Al-Omar Field in Syria was targeted with dozens of rockets. The situation remains volatile along Lebanon's southern border, with the resistance movement Hezbollah and Israel continuing to exchange fire. Earlier, we were joined by our correspondent in southern Lebanon, Mariam Saleh, for more details.
The new developments concerning the Israeli shelling of South Lebanon, we do have a direct targeting of a mosque in the border town of Abbasiyeh. And we know that there is a lot of damage that has been done in this mosque that is partially destroyed. And that is the latest concerning the Israeli shelling. We also have in the town of Taibe, which is not a bordering town, but still has been the subject of heavy Israeli shelling, where the Israelis actually targeted the supplies of water and electricity, all the necessities, the civilian infrastructure in that town and other towns as well, not only in that town. But of course, the Israelis are also somewhat going beyond the boundaries. We did have a couple of days ago another attack on the area of Kawthariyat As-Siyad. Perhaps there, Israelis are saying this was a false alarm. It was an empty factory, actually, a cement factory. And so it seemed that the Israelis had wrong intelligence that perhaps there would be Hezbollah fighters in that area. That didn't seem to be the case.
In the occupied West Bank, Palestinians have laid to rest the victims of an Israeli airstrike on the city of Jenin. The funeral procession was held for six Palestinians, including four brothers of a family. They lost their lives after an Israeli aircraft opened fire at a gathering of Palestinians on Sunday. The airstrike took place during a raid by the regime forces on the Jenin refugee camp. Israel has intensified its raids in the West Bank since October the 7th. Over the past 3 months, hundreds of Palestinians have been killed, and over 4,000 others have been abducted in the occupied territory. Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah has hit an Israeli military base with a barrage of rockets and missiles. The group says the attack was a preliminary response to the regime's assassination of a senior Hamas leader inside of Lebanon. We took a closer look at what happened during the Explainer program.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Explainer. I'm Gisumisha Ahmadi. Hezbollah has attacked an Israeli military base in what has been described as an answer to Israel's targeted assassination inside Lebanon. Hezbollah's attack was swift, precise, and sent a strong message to Israel of Hezbollah's capabilities. Now, this is how Israel's targeted assassination went down. An undetected drone that pinpointed a second-floor apartment in southern Beirut, a combination of a Hermes drone and Nimrod missile, the intended target and casualty, Saleh al-Aruri, a former leader of the Qassam Brigade and a member of the political bureau of Hamas. Hezbollah's Secretary General Sayed Hassan Nasrallah vowed retaliation, and he did, in a big way. 62 missiles of various types were fired at Meron, a vital Israeli military post. Hezbollah called it a preliminary response. So what types of missiles were used? It is not really known, but most likely consisted of a combination of some of the missiles that you see here, a snapshot of Hezbollah's firepower, most notably rockets like Fateh 110 and Fajr 3 and Fajr 5 missiles. The question that needs to be asked here is, where was the Israeli deterrent, like the Iron Dome missile system that is meant to deter missiles from contact? One possible scenario, Hezbollah diverted the Iron Dome with the drones or maybe missiles or a combination of both, although this cannot be proven and it's just a theory. Ever since October 7th, Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, Israel and Hezbollah have been targeting and trading fire along the border. This is the area and the approximate location of their military equipment and personnel. Heavy military assets on both sides, as you can see, from tanks to drones to fighter jets, and of course, a large cache of weapons and missiles. The result from the Hezbollah side, 670 operations against Israel over the past 3 months, 48 border sites and communities targeted more than once, with over 2,000 Israeli casualties and 4 Israeli civilian deaths. Israel's figures, however, are always underreported. Meanwhile, Israeli attacks number around 230, with 145 Hezbollah fighters killed. The civilian death toll is around 30, which clearly shows why Hezbollah has retaliated so often. Since we're on the borders, the border area between Israel and southern Lebanon, it is called the Blue Line, established by the United Nations in the year 2000. It forced the departure of Israeli troops from southern Lebanon after an 18-year occupation. Recently, Israel announced that it was Hezbollah to withdraw beyond the Litani River in southern Lebanon, as seen here, to reduce tensions, as Israel said. After the targeted assassination, of course, that is highly unlikely. And finally, the Philadelphia Corridor, or the Philadelphia Route, a border area between Gaza and Egypt. Israel has said it wants to take control of this area. Israel's reason, quote unquote, it must be in our hands to ensure the security that Tel Aviv desires.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Thank you. visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Economic divide.
The U.S.-Israeli genocidal war has not slowed down, even during the new year. While the death toll is increasing, thanks to the U.S. military support, the Israeli economy is doing poorly. From the stock market to the stretched-out budget to a lack of workers, there's no telling how Israel can actually climb out of this economic crisis. Hi, I'm Kavit Ahvai. Welcome to Economic Divide. Some of the highlights coming up: Israel's double whammy. The year has drawn to a close, so we'll look at that. For example, the judicial reforms, of course, the U.S.-Israeli genocidal war, and then the outcomes and the consequences of this has shown itself, for example, in the stock market, which is not doing as well as it did before the onslaught. Then, boycotting Israel. That's right, we're looking at Malaysia. Malaysia is one of the countries, unprecedented, that has prevented Israeli ships from docking at its ports. And also Yemen targeting Israeli-linked vessels. Next up, this is a problem for Israel: the debt, rising budget deficit as a result of the debt that's being accumulated, 5 to 6% of the GDP projected for next year. $50 billion in funds is required. Israel's economy is now in a crisis as it was hit by a double whammy this year: the so-called judicial overhaul and the U.S.-Israel genocidal war. Local stocks have underperformed global stocks this year. At the beginning of the year, the local stock market was shadowed by growing political uncertainty around the proposed judicial overhaul. The planned proposal sparked fears that the changes to the regime's legal system would threaten the independence of the judiciary and make business and investments less predictable. Over the course of the year, total equity raised from the public plunged to about 8.2 billion shekels from 21.7 billion shekels in 2022, while the average daily trading volume was down 12% year on year. The public withdrew a massive 30 billion shekels from funds that invest in shares and bonds in Tel Aviv, and poured 20.5 billion shekels into funds that invest in securities abroad. And following Israel's genocide in Gaza and the ensuing hostilities, Israeli securities initially dropped and the shekel plunged to the weakest level in more than a decade. Time now for our social media post. Israel's decision to bar more than 100,000 Palestinian workers from entering Israel has shrunk the pool of low-cost labor. This, in turn, has hurt the economy. Next, Malaysia, well done for banning Israeli shipping company Zim and vessels with Israeli flags from its ports. This responds to Israel's ongoing hashtag Gaza genocide against 2.3 million Palestinians in Gaza, sets a powerful example of holding Israel to account. Our next entry is a website: Israel has lost the war against Hamas, Netanyahu to be ousted. That came from the former Israeli chief of staff. And finally, Israel sees defense spending rising, we call it war spending, to $8 billion as the war rages. Those were some of the entries there. It shows how this onslaught is taking a toll on Israel's economy in one form or another. Let me introduce our guest for the first segment of the Q&A. John Gahan is an activist and political analyst who joins us. John Gahan, welcome to the program. So my first question has to be about the fact that you're looking at the year drawing to a close. At this point, it has. The year 2024 is upon us. But Israel experienced a double whammy: judicial overhaul, so-called, and also this U.S.-Israeli genocidal war. We're looking, for example, the impact it has had on the stock market, down 12%. But both scenarios have battered Israeli markets and its economy. In your opinion, how bad was this economy impacted?
Well, I think the slaughter in Gaza, the ethnic cleansing, which borders on genocide, I think is costing Israel a great deal in terms of money, just actual funding, and certainly in terms of world support, perception. I think they have lost that war, the war for public opinion.
All right, thank you for that. Let me bring in our next guest. Michael Santomora joins us. He's a freelance journalist and blogger. Michael Santomora, welcome to Economic Divide. Had an unprecedented event take place, and the country responsible for that was Malaysia, that it actually announced, because of the U.S. genocidal war on the Gaza Strip, that it's going to boycott Israel when it comes to its vessels. It's not going to allow them to dock at its ports. Even Israeli-linked vessels, in some respects, will be under scrutiny. How unprecedented is that? And do you think that would be the beginning of a trend when it comes to the whole boycott campaign against Israel?
Well, you don't see it with the European Union. Malaysia is an important player in the global economy. But you do see it on the street level. I mean, just recently there were 400,000 people demonstrating in favor of the people of Gaza and the Palestinian cause just in London alone. You see it here in capitals in the United States and throughout the Western Hemisphere. That will have an impact, maybe not in the short term, but definitely in the long term. These are young professionals, a lot of college students. They're going to have an impact on this region for the years down the road. There'll be the new generation that will join people like Malaysia. And recently, South Africa has pressed war crimes in the International Criminal Court against Israel. That kind of activity on the part of some of the other countries that are considered peripheral here in the United States will become probably the dominant attitude and sensibility for the next new generation, the young generation of today.
Time now for the Infinite News section of the program. First up, we've covered this item before, but it has happened again, and it's pretty gross, and that is the theft of organs by the Israeli regime forces. In this particular case in point, Israel has stolen the organs of 80 Palestinians whose bodies were abducted by the regime's invading troops in Gaza. The regime returned the bodies to Gaza in a state of decomposition, which made their identification difficult. In case you're wondering why mentioning this again, well, there's some finances behind this, because these organs obviously can be sold or they can be used, so it does have an economic flavor to it, so to speak. But it's really just shocking that at this particular point in time, even though Israel has done this before, that this is happening again. Next up, a crisis that's happening between Israel and Jordan. It concerns water. This entry said they steal and humiliate us. Why water is at the center of Jordan-Israel tensions. Said Israel can decide to cut off our water supply, like it did in Gaza, from one day to the next, and it's a question of survival, not to depend on them anymore. Next up, settlements. They're illegal, and there's funding that's coming from the U.S. Crowdfunding site Israel Gives allows U.S. residents to donate millions to paramilitary groups, IOF units, and to settlers. The causes include illegal West Bank settlements, and the paramilitary groups, as we just mentioned, and also the regime forces who are currently operating in Gaza and also in the occupied West Bank. And then finally, we take a look at the onslaught and the cost that it has on the occupied West Bank's economy. The toll of this onslaught has taken has had a deep impact economically on the West Bank. Businesses have closed. Tens of thousands can't work in Israel. And analysts warn that a continued decline could spark more violence. Some of the entries we picked for this segment.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
The U.S. Israeli genocidal war is taking a bite out of Israel's economy. That is for certain. But how is Israel dealing with it? Specifically, which sectors are suffering? And where are the budget shortfalls? And ultimately, the financial impact? Well, we're going to do our best to explain that in this in-depth section. First up, let's take a look at the overall budget. The Israeli Finance Ministry has come out with one. Of course, that's a very tough figure to figure out, but this is what he has thought in terms of the overall budget, $155 billion. That represents a $13.67 billion increase based on what we're seeing here. Now, in terms of the budget itself, we're going to figure out what it is allocating. For example, the war costs, this is how they have broken it down. The Hamas onslaught that they're executing is $13.8 billion. When it comes to the war budget itself, it's $22.3 billion. The increase there is $8.3 billion, keeping in mind that you have a $269 million daily cost that this onslaught is incurring on a budget, which they don't know how to even figure out the different figures. So you have to keep all of that in mind. Then comes various budget allocations. This figure is set aside for things that they mentioned. It's $2.77 billion for things like the evacuation of individuals from the north and southern borders, or for what they have called police and security services, and also the reconstruction of illegal settlements that were damaged from the Operation Al-Aqsa flood. So again, another increase that's going to put weight on the budget in the amount of $2.77 billion. And what do we have? They call it other financial costs. In terms of what other means, well, the figure itself is $2.44 billion. And these are pretty heavy figures if you think about it. And the reason for this is because of the debt financing. If they want to borrow money, for example, that's one of the factors that they have to look at. And also interest rates to pay for the money, they have to pay for the interest. And they figured it's about $2.44 billion. Next up, no surprise, really, when it comes down to it, that Israel is going to come short. In terms of the revenues, what they even have admitted to, $9.7 billion, that there's going to be a budget shortfall. And that will be due to a variety of things, but mainly corporate and real estate taxes that are going down, for example. And also, you have private consumption that has plummeted. Now we move on to the war budget itself, whether that's going to fall short or not. Take a guess. I'm sure you have taken the right guess. The amount that has come short is minus $20 billion, of which, in order to make up for the shortfall, these are the types of things that they are thinking of doing, and some are in motion. For example, closing down 10 ministries and also increasing the tax on the value-added taxes. These two are the ones that have been recommended at this point to make up for that $20 billion deficit. So obviously we can see how the Israeli economy is in a crisis mode because of all these different shortfalls that they have and how they have to make up for it. And finally, we're going to take a look at the Israeli budget deficit overall when it comes to all these costs that have been incurred, such as also lower income that they will accumulate. It will lead to a budget deficit of around 5.9%, okay, of the gross domestic product for the year that's upcoming, we're in right now, which is 2024. And this is something that is definitely going to leave question marks as to how they're going to generate that money. Then that is the whole point of the generation of this money and where it's going to come from, which would be a good topic for us to obviously dive into with our guest. Let me reintroduce them. We have John Gahan, who's an activist and political analyst, rejoining us. John Gahan, welcome back to the program. Debt is something that Israel is dealing with and is sharply increasing as we speak. The budget deficit is amounting to about 5 to 6% of the gross domestic product. We're looking at the fact that they need to make up this deficit in one way or another. How will they do that? And actually, how hard is that going to be?
Well, keep in mind that Israel has a sugar daddy. That's a term we use in the United States, a very wealthy and generous funder, which is certainly, obviously, the United States. I suspect that given the Zionist influence on the U.S. government, that the U.S. government will be supporting, financially supporting Israel into the at least the near future. It's a problem that we need to address here in the United States. The Zionist influence is very powerful on the president and on the United States Congress.
Yeah, we have to wait and see whether that's indeed going to happen or not. Let me bring Michael Santomaro back, a freelance journalist and blogger, and see what he thinks. Michael Santomaro, welcome back to Economic Divide. You know, this budget shortfall that Israel is experiencing needs to have some cash injections into it. It doesn't look like they're going to be able to make that up in terms of income that's generated, whether it's from taxes or cutting any type of, I guess, costs since they are going through this genocidal war. So the big question is, will they be able to generate that cash? Will they be able to make up that deficit?
Well, if it was another decade, another era, a different U.S. president, it'd probably be impossible. But Biden is surrounded by a predominantly Zionist neocon cabinet and staff, and he'll give Israel whatever it needs. A lot of the monies that the Congress doesn't want to give to Ukraine, they're willing to allocate to Israel. And the reason for that is because Israel here in the United States has always been a domestic issue. It's not a foreign policy issue. Because the Jewish American population, which is only about 2 or 3% of the population, represents the majority and plurality for political donations to both political parties.
The war has also incurred heavy losses on Israel's economy. Debt will grow sharply, assuming that the budget deficit in the Israeli economy will amount to 5 to 6% of gross domestic product next year, which means that the finance ministry will need to raise about 200 billion shekels in 2024. And that's more than the two-thirds of the amount in all of 2023 and four times the amount in 2022. The regime is also suffering massively due to the boycott campaign that has been launched against the regime. Some of the companies hit by the boycott campaign have taken pro-Israeli stances, and some are alleged to have financial ties to Israel or investments there. Just recently, Malaysia banned Israeli-owned ships and other vessels heading to Israel from docking at all domestic ports, and the regime is facing another front that has impacted its economy. The Yemeni army is targeting any vessel or tanker affiliated to Israel in the Red Sea. Even the port of Eilat is said to be close to being completely shut down.
Hello and welcome to the Quick Take section. I'm Matti Apossian. One of the factors which have affected the Israeli economy in a big way is the employees factor. Israel has faced staffing shortages in a number of sectors. For example, as many as 7,000 Thai nationals make up the largest share of the agricultural workforce have fled Israel. The Israeli Ministry of Agriculture has proposed a plan to hire 8,000 Palestinians from the West Bank, but far-right minister Itamar Ben-Gvir has rejected that, citing a security risk. It is reported that India plans to send 10,000 construction workers to Israel for contracts that would last 1 to 5 years. This agreement would allow 42,000 Indian workers to go to Israel for work. One of the ways to gauge the number of Israelis disengaged from the Israeli economy is through how many people are receiving unemployment benefits. Based on a December 10th report, 173,000 settlers have requested unemployment benefits since October. Israeli companies are facing shortages across the board due to the deployment of about 300,000 people, or 8% of the workforce, for military service. The number of Israeli businesses closing has also led to a massive decrease in the Israeli revenues and, of course, the economy itself. And the number of closures is quite shocking. One report has indicated that 57,000 Israeli companies will close their doors this year. This is while the budget has set aside $1 billion to help businesses avert a shutdown. Additionally, the West Bank's economy has suffered a heavy 37% decline in production, resulting in a $500 million monthly loss for the Israeli budget. That does it for this Quick Take section. I'm Matt Yapasyan, and I'll catch you next week.
The Israeli onslaught is taking a toll on Israel's economy. That's a fact. As the onslaught continues, Israel needs to figure out how it can stop its industries from unraveling, like its tech industry. Investors will not invest in the occupied territories if there's no political solution in sight, especially given the specter that the crisis may spread into the wider region, which puts a damper upon any type of economic rebound that Israel may hope for. That does it for this edition of the program. Thank you so much for being with us. We enjoyed it. I hope you did. If you did or didn't, more importantly, send us some comments or reactions or suggestions. We would really appreciate it. From Mikhail Tapley and the entire team here at The Economic Divide, it's goodbye until the next program.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us, to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. This is Hussein Latifi, and you're listening to a program for humanity from IRIB English Radio. In this program, we talk about the concept of a human being in the Holy Quran. And in previous episodes, we were talking about different dimensions of the human soul, and one of them was fitra. We talked about different arguments based on fitra that is unique in the Islamic theology. And one of them was based on the argument or the thought experiment of the Stormices. The other was based on finding out the inner yearning for limitless perfection that we have within our souls, which indicates and which leads us toward something that is capable of quenching this thirst. We talked about how people feel miserable after again and again feeling unhappy after they achieve what they had in mind as the goals in life, and then after a while they get fed up with that and they want more. It's like the state of being addicted to something when you have to add to the dose of that thing in order to feel happy like the way you felt happy before. And people end up feeling unhappy in their life, and sometimes even commit suicide while they're very wealthy, they have good conditions. And we said that that is because they have not found the real answer to the need that they have. And it's like the example of the salty water. In our hadith, we have that dunya is like the salty water of the sea. It doesn't add to the one who drinks it except for more thirst. It doesn't quench the thirst of the person in the opposite. While the person thinks and believes that I'm taking water, but at the same time, he only feels more thirsty. So dunya is like that. And the nature of the pleasures of dunya and the perfections that we think are the perfections are like that. So there should be something that quenches the thirst of the person. And that is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And that is another argument from fitra. And another thing that fitra has is that this, before coming to ideological framing of the teachings, as I said earlier, that when we say this fitra proves Allah, it does not prove the name Allah or Yahovah or I don't know God. It proves that being that is limitless perfection, that a person would believe that by achieving, by reaching, by arriving there, he has the answer of all questions, of all the imperfections that I have suffered from. And then that is something that is left within human soul as a trustee of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, as the innate nature that we all share. Another function of that fitrah is that the divine religion, before being framed into an ideological system or theological school, has that fitra within it. It corresponds to the fitra of people. Fitra is the language that you can talk to or you can receive the message of the true divine religion. And this is interesting and very important, crucial. When people encounter the Holy Quran, I think we had said this before, that Quran is the only divine scripture that claims that it's a person, not a book. And we have this in our teachings, in our riwayat, that on the Day of Judgment, Quran is resurrected in the form of a person. And we don't have this about the divine scriptures of other religions, and I have not seen this claim about their scriptures within their own theological system. This is unique in Islam. So, on the Day of Judgment, Quran is resurrected in the form of a person. We will have a break and we come back to continue the discussion of how Quran is a living being that we can make a connection to, and we just need to have the proper language to make that connection.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. This is Hossein Latifi, and you're listening to your program for humanity from IRIB English Radio. We were talking about the fact that the Holy Quran has been introduced in our riwayat and in our spiritual teachings as a living being, and on the Day of Judgment it will be resurrected as a living person. And we said that the example of the analogy of us and the Holy Quran is like a person, two people who met each other, but they don't understand the language of each other. If I encounter the Holy Quran, but the language that I am talking and asking my question from the Holy Quran is the language of carnal desires, I don't get my answers. Actually, there is no meaningful encounter. Like, for example, you speak Chinese, I speak English, we encounter. It's a minimum level of mutual understanding that takes place between us. But once we encounter each other with the language that is there, that we share, we can take benefit. And that language for encountering the Holy Quran is the language of fitrah. If a person encounters the Holy Quran with the language of fitrah, that fitrah which looks for limitless perfection, which looks for those qualities and virtues that any human being deserves to have, deserves to achieve in life, then he or she will see that Quran is answering him, and not just answering him in a miraculous way. Like, just as you read some lines, you have some questions, in the next line, as if it already knows that you have this question, it answers your question. And many people have reported this. Once they have used their fitrah, the innate nature that they have taken away all the curtains of the desires, all the feelings that they had. Sometimes people feel sad, sometimes people sit angry. When they have put all the feelings aside, with the fitrah, the innate nature of yearning for eternal perfection, and they have posed their answers to the Holy Quran. Istantaqu, I think we talked about this in some episode, that Imam Ali alayhi salam said, Istantaqu, you should bring Quran to the table and ask him questions in order to answer you. When you pose your questions to Quran, then you realize that Quran starts answering you little by little, little by little. So the communication way that we have with Quran is fitrah. At the level of fitrah, put aside all the ideological teachings and, I don't know, as they say, indoctrinated teachings that you had with you all the ways, put that aside and try to have a fresh encounter with Quran based on fitrah, not based on carnal desire, not based on, I don't know, a scientific book. No, based on a manual of a human being in a journey that he or she has towards perfection. And you will find that it starts answering you, it starts communicating with you. And many people have reported that. So this is also another function of fitrah, that with fitrah, we find out the hujjah. We have this actually in our riwayat, that بالفترات تتم الحج if I'm not mistaken that it is through فترة تثبت الحج إمام رضا عليه السلام says بالفترات تثبت الحج it is through فترة that Allah سبحانه وتعالى talks with people and argues with people on the day of judgment. Thank you very much for listening. Inshallah until next episode place me in your du'as. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
صلى الله على محمد صلى الله على النبي صلى الله على محمد وعلى آل النبي.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.